We tend to look at accomplishing our life goals as a process requiring steady pressure, constant work or sweat, or persistence, or just plain fighting. Today's guest offers an alternative. Dr. Judith Orloff suggests we might be pushing too hard and not letting things happen. Dr. Orloff's book on the matter is The Ecstasy of Surrender, 12 Surprising Ways Letting Go Can Empower Your Life. If you've heard the name before, you're right. Dr. Judith Orloff is an MD and assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at UCLA, author of several other books, including Emotional Freedom. She's a veteran of TED Talks and TV and radio appearances, and we're glad to have her here on this one. Dr. Judith Orloff, thanks.
Oh, hi. It's great to be here.
You've blazed a pretty good trail by this point. Where does this book go that your previous ones did not?
Well, when I was thinking about what kind of book I would like to write, what I wanted most in my life was the ability to surrender more. I tend to be a bit of a control freak, and so I can hold on too tightly and push too hard and get tense. And so I wanted to learn how to let go more in my life so that I could have more joy. And so, you know, I wanted to write a book on how can you apply this art of letting go to all areas, from success to relationships to aging.
This is a fairly difficult concept, I think, for many people to embrace, the idea of getting what you want by loosening your grasp a bit.
I know. It seems counterintuitive. You think surrender won't work because traditionally they think of surrender as the putting down the white flag, defeat, weakness. But as a psychiatrist, I've been in practice for over 20 years. And I'm telling you, it's a missing piece to health, wellness, and success. That's the way I'm defining surrender, is that you have to know when to move forward and when to exert control and when to let go. As I've seen so many of my patients sabotage themselves by pushing too hard. And how do you know when to let go? You have to listen to your intuition and listen to the signs that tell you, you know, maybe pushing isn't the best thing right now, so you can regroup.
But what if your intuition, just because of the way it's been built up over the years through your own life's training, just tells you to continue to push or even push harder? I mean, we all know people who've thought, well, I'm not getting where I want to be, so I'm going to have to work even harder than I am now.
All right, then I would suggest that, you know, people really take time to drop into their intuition a little bit more, because if they're pushing harder and not getting results, that's not their intuition. The intuition is if you go inside and you just listen to your gut. You know, and let's say you've made all the calls you can make. You know, do you want to make 10 more? Do you want to keep calling the same people over and over again and alienating them? I don't think so. You have to know the difference between wanting what you want when you want it and, you know, when is it a truly the best time to move forward. And so I would, you know, take a few, there's a 3-minute meditation in the book to surrender to your intuition. And just take 3 minutes, that's it, just to breathe, get very quiet. Center yourself and listen to what your gut says, apart from what you want, apart from all your ambition or desires. Just listen. And it usually will tell you the right thing or give you alternative approaches to the one you're choosing. Because if you keep hitting a brick wall, even though you want something, you know, that's a sign telling you to stop and regroup.
Was there any hesitation on your part, Dr. Orloff, to using the term surrender? Because it's one that that doesn't have a pretty connotation for a lot of people. And then when you get to the second part of that, surrender to whom or to what?
Right. Yes, that's exactly why I wanted to use it. Because, you know, surrender in mystical spiritual circles is a highly thought of term in terms of, you know, just having devotion to love or devotion to a person or devotion to a higher power. You know, that kind of surrendering yourself to something larger, it's a deep sign of humility. But in Western culture, you know, we consider it defeat. So, yes, I wanted to use the word surrender to create the discussion, you know, the discussion about what it is and why it can help you. I mean, I've spoken to, you know, Donald Trump, and I interviewed Jerry Levin, who used to run AOL Time Warner. And, you know, they both, you know, say that knowing when to let go is a very important part of business. So it's a missing piece. If you want to be more successful than you ever have been before, learning to integrate knowing when to let go, knowing how to approach people in a bit of a less aggressive, bombastic, pushy way, it can only help you.
So the whole idea of surrendering, again, counterintuitive to a lot of people, but, you know, it sounds like you put yourself through some significant life changes while writing this.
I did. You know, oftentimes when I write a book, I get, you know, the universe brings me what I need to learn. and I've had to give up so much, you know, in service of something better. I mean, I'm so much better as a result. But I've had to give up the place where I wrote all my books because of unrelenting noise and construction. I had to give up an address for a nomadic lifestyle for a while as I was writing. And I've had to give up, you know, a relationships and a therapist and various things along the way, which has been, you know, so incredible in the long run. As what you get from giving up things that don't work for you is that you get a lightness of being. You get a happiness. You get a load lifted off of you. You know, and when I gave up my condo, I gave away all my possessions in addition to that because I just wanted to. I just looked at them and I was tired of them. So I just gave them away to charity or to my friends. So whatever I got another place, I could start fresh. And it's like uncluttering your life. It is so powerful. So you don't have all this weighing you down. You're just free. You're free to do whatever you want to do. And then you can, I could start over with new furniture or whatever. But it was just a lot in my life had to go. I was leading a life that was a bit too small for me. And so, you know, surrender has helped me, you know, find the life of my dreams, essentially.
All right. The Ecstasy of Surrender is the book. Dr. Judith Orloff, MD, is the guest and the author. We'll come back and talk more with her and take your phone calls and emails as well. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. More on the Ecstasy of Surrender with Dr. Judith Orloff and you when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Judith Orloff, psychiatrist and clinical professor of psychiatry at UCLA. She's the author of a number of books. The latest one is called The Ecstasy of Surrender, 12 Surprising Ways That Letting Go Can Empower Your Life. We're getting further into the details of the book as we go along. You can join us on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Judith, there's a lot of people, I think, get hung up on the concept of surrender. This is surrender, but it's not resignation. You're not actually giving up on your life goals here, right?
No, you're not giving up on your life goals, and you're not being passive. And surrender is particularly a hot button for men because, you know, men, the last thing men want to do is surrender because they think it's defeat. Women, on the other hand, kind of know the advantages of it. I mean, just think about having an orgasm. You can't have one without surrendering. It would be very, very hard. Or think about laughter, you know, just letting go to laughter or letting go to a good cry, you know, or just letting go to having fun. You know, all of that is essential. You know, the surrender is so essential for all of that. And so you just want to apply that to your life. For example, you know, you want to surrender energy vampires in your life, the toxic people who suck you dry. You do not want to keep them around. And surrendering means letting them go or learning to set clear limits and boundaries with them so that they don't drain you. All right? So surrender has a very positive effect with that. You want to let go of certain things. You don't want to accumulate, you know. And, you know, secondly, let's say you're having an argument with your spouse and you give up the need to be right in that argument. Let's say you want to surrender that and you allow your spouse to be right. Do you know the positive effects that will have on your relationship as opposed to you digging in your heels? And maybe you are right and maybe you make your point, but maybe you get a divorce as a result. So it's really the art of living. It's knowing when, you know, to give other people things, you know, rather than you're right, you're going to stick to that to the end of your life, and then you give up everything that's meaningful, you know, just because you're right. I've seen so many of my patients get stuck in that. So surrendering helps in communication and relationship by letting someone be right and also not interrupting them. You know, it's very important not to interrupt people in conversations, even if you disagree with them, you know, and that's a form of surrender, and then you can speak your own truth. So it's just about learning how to flow with people rather than you know what to do and you're just going to forge forward. Now, surrender is a deep form of empathy. You know, it's about, you know, really trying to see where another person is at and then choosing a powerful place to come from, you know, in order to approach them. So it's not just I know I'm right and I'm going to make my point no matter what. You know, that's rather egotistical and insensitive, and it won't work. You know, in terms of if you want to really succeed in business, if you really want to find love in your life, you know, you have to learn how to be a bit flexible. You know, it's a lot like, you know, if a big wave breaks on you, you know, if you struggle a lot with that wave, then you're just going to be demolished. But if you're able to relax with any wave, with any challenge of life, that's how surrendering can help you. That will make your passage a lot less painful.
In the wave example, literally going with the flow, trying to go with it rather than go against it.
Well, you have to, because anybody who's gone under a wave knows how horrible it is if you struggle. You know, you really can get hurt. You know, and all surfers know that. And the same is true with life. Life is a lot like, you know, a big wave sometimes, because so much happens to us. As a psychiatrist, I know that, you know, we're faced with so many challenges in life, loss, betrayals, relationship breakups, you know, just so many illness, pain, you know, financial struggles, all of that. You know, if we tense up during all of those struggles, we're going to make it so much worse for ourselves. And surrendering through even tumultuous times will make it like at least 50% easier for people.
Judith Orloff is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Ecstasy of Surrender. The book is divided into five major sections. Part one, power and money. Accumulating power and money, it seems like, is kind of the opposite of surrender, isn't it?
No, not at all. Not at all. It's just what I'm saying is, before you accumulate anything or do anything on the external world, you have to come from a place of heart, and you have to be connected with yourself and have your priorities straight so that you can feel a bit of happiness inside. So when you make money or you are successful, you can enjoy it. That's what I've seen with my patients who are in the film industry, and I work with a lot of celebrities and film people, is that they can have everything in the world, everything. But if they're not happy, they don't enjoy it. You have to be happy first before you can enjoy something. And that's a principle that, you know, a lot of people don't get. They think if they make $20 million, they're going to be happy. And it just isn't so. I mean, Jim Carrey, I just read a wonderful quote by him. And he said, I wish everybody could get everything they ever wanted in their lives, and they could see that that's not the answer.
This seems like a big one, though, in part one, about surrendering comparisons. Comparisons to what, and why surrender those?
Well, you know, you surrender comparisons to other people who you think have more than you, you know, or that or that have a better body than you, or that have more money than you, or have a relationship and you don't. Whatever, you know, the other person has that you think you don't have, you know, rather than torment yourself, what I'm suggesting, no, is that each of our paths is absolutely perfect, and that we're given the challenges that we need to get. And part of developing ourselves is learning deep self-compassion. And when you go to the yoga class, do the class. Don't look at the woman or man with a beautiful body next to you and torment yourself. You know, just do the class and enjoy what you have. Because when you could look at other people, let's say they have what you want, then see their methods. You know, try to surrender your envy and just see their methods so that you can copy them and learn from them and admire them, you know, rather than just torment yourself. Because when you compare yourself with others, it is a way to fuel low self-esteem, you see. And I know comparisons are very natural, and they're some of them are good. You know, like you see somebody and you want to admire them and you use them as role models. But where it isn't good as a psychiatrist and what needs to be surrendered is the torment of the self that comes from comparisons, or I'm not good enough, I'm not beautiful enough, I'm not, you know, rich enough, or whatever. And, you know, just as a wake-up call, you know, I just want to tell everyone, I've worked with a lot of people who are dying, and on their deathbeds, they never say, I wish I made more money, or I wish I worked longer hours. They always say, I wish I had more love, I wish I took the risks that I never took, I wish I followed my heart. That's what they say. And so I think we need to learn from that in order how to lead our lives now. you know, in terms of priorities, keeping surrendering to love, trying to love yourself the best you can, trying to surrender these comparisons, which are the antithesis of self-love, and, you know, just knowing what's important and not working too much. I'm just trying to tell people, don't work too much. You know, in Europe, you know, they have a beautiful month vacation in the summer. They think, you know, us Westerners are crazy to work so much. And I think too much work takes a toll, and we're crazy about work in this culture. You know, take some time to enjoy yourself other than work.
I don't know if you saw it, but during the Olympics, they ran this Cadillac ad a lot that made reference to the fact that Europeans work a lot less than we do, or that we work a lot more than they do. But the point was that as a result, we get Cadillacs for it, you know?
Yeah, but who needs a Cadillac? Honestly, you know, you don't. Cadillac isn't going to keep you warm at night. You know, it's going to be the love. You know, spend some time loving people. You know, spend more time loving people and less working. You know, that's how I feel. You know, I take a pretty hard line on this. That's why I, you know, wrote this book on surrender. I really want people to be happy, and there are certain things that will guarantee happiness, and I can tell you that with assuredness. And one of them is surrendering to love. Working all those long hours will not guarantee you happiness. What it will do, you know, maybe it will get you your goal, you know, and that creates a lot of satisfaction. I understand that. I'm not against working hard. I think working hard is beautiful. But what you need to do is balance that with doing other things as well and not only working, you know, to be able to love people, to be able to go out in nature and enjoy this planet, to be able to look up and see that we're a tiny speck in this universe and how much wonder and awe that is. The problem I have with people working so much is that they forget the wonder and awe of being human, and they forget to enjoy this planet that we're on and explore it and understand it. You know, all they're doing is staying in a cubicle working and worrying and pushing, and that's not good for the human soul.
Again, Dr. Judith Orloff, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's a psychiatrist and assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at UCLA and the author of the book, The Ecstasy of Surrender, 12 Surprising Ways Letting Go Can Empower Your Life. Join us on the Exchange as we talk about this, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email here, Judith, from Tim in Eureka. He writes, I have recently been introduced to Joel S. Goldsmith's writings and his teachings on resting. They seem similar to what your speaker is suggesting. The concept is becoming less controversial with the popular experience of meditating on the divine within and letting the truth exude. I'd like to hear your speaker's thoughts on Joel S. Goldsmith's writings.
Yes, I'm afraid I don't know of him, but he sounds incredible, and I'm a big proponent of resting. And you know, part of the surrender techniques that I teach in the book, you know, have to do with all kinds of meditations, because meditation is my primary spiritual practice. And there's a 3-minute meditation in the book that people can practice just to surrender and stop for 3 minutes during their busy days to go inside, to connect, to feel the bliss.
We have lost our phone line, that is pretty clear, with Judith Orloff, and we're going to work to get that right back now. Judith Orloff is an assistant clinical professor of psychology at UCLA, an MD, a medical doctor. She is the author of several other books, including Emotional Freedom. She's a veteran of TED Talks and TV and radio appearances. The book we're talking to her about today is called The Ecstasy of Surrender, 12 Surprising Ways That Letting Go Can Empower Your Life. And it's a tricky process to get the concept across to people, because surrender does not mean you're giving up. It means you're going about things a different way. It's kind of the let go and let God approach that is often talked about in Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, getting things back on track. So that is our guest today, Dr. Judith Orloff. The book, again, The Ecstasy of Surrender. Looks like we've reestablished the line, and here she is back with us. Judith, I'm not sure what happened there, but welcome back.
I think we got interrupted in bliss when I was talking about bliss.
All right, yeah, I wanted to get back to that, though, because the 3-minute heart meditation is very important.
It is, because even, you know, if you have a busy lifestyle and you want to not be pressured all day long, the 3-minute meditation to surrender is so important, and it's just 3 minutes. I tell people to limit it to 3 minutes, to not meditate any longer, because I know people are afraid of longer meditations. They just simply don't have the time to do it. And so you just stop for 3 minutes in your office. I have some patients who do it in their cars before meetings. I do it in airports because I get very thrown off in airports. And so you just, for 3 minutes, close your eyes, breathe, relax the diaphragm, relax the chest, allow your body to relax, and focus on something you really love, something that's very heart-centered or loving, maybe your children, a beautiful sunset, a flower, water, flowing water, or the night sky. But really let yourself drop into that space and let go to it. Allow the muscular tension to melt. And just in that 3 minutes, you can reconnect with your heart and relax all of those stress hormones that are surging through your body during your day so you can be clear. And then with that clarity, you go about your day again. And I can't tell you how useful that is for my patients and myself. And it only takes 3 minutes. You know, it's surprising that such a short period of time can really refocus you, but it really works. And, you know, for those who are skeptical about surrender who are listening, I can understand that, but just try some of the techniques in the book and see if they work. I know they do because I'm not interested in anything that doesn't yield results. As I practice all this, I don't have the time for anything that doesn't yield results. And so even if your mind is saying, I don't know how this is going to help me make more money or in my business or in my family, just try. You know, just surrender the need to be right with your wife or your husband once and see how happy that makes them. Just try it. And then that will encourage you to use more of the techniques in the book to surrender.
It's really interesting the way that you turn what people might see as negatives, you know, surrendering, giving up, giving in, whatever, into positives. And that's particularly true when you talk about surrendering low self-esteem, where you're essentially giving up a negative. So it ends up being a positive.
Exactly. You want to surrender anything that stands in your way of happiness. And low self-esteem is one thing that's very common amongst most people. You know, they might look like they have it all together on the outside. Believe me, I've treated people who run this and run that, and they have the lowest self-esteem in the world. And I can't get it across enough to people that just because people look good or they seem to be so successful, when you actually talk to them and they're authentic, many of them feel just as bad as the rest of us. I mean, in terms of low self-esteem. So it doesn't guarantee that, you know, that it makes you happy. But when you have high self-esteem, you know, when you really begin to like yourself and say, hey, I'm looking good today. I feel good about the way I treated that person. I feel good about how I've, you know, practicing self-care. I feel good that I'm breathing instead of clenching. I feel good that I went out in nature today and had some moments of enjoyment. When you start to feed yourself with those kinds of thoughts, it's like, you know, just like nectar to the soul. It builds you up. It makes you feel really good. But unfortunately, people often focus on the 90% of their lives that is not working, and the 10% that is not working, rather than the 90% that is. It's human nature. So what I'm asking people to do is shift your mind, take control of your mind, and focus on what is working. You know, just today, you're driving, you're listening to the show, you're, you know, at home, just focus on what you do have right now in this moment and really begin to savor it, not just for a second, not just for 2 seconds, but really, you know, focus on what you love and let it sink in. It's like food. It's like energetic food when you can allow yourself to let that gratitude in. It feeds you. And it helps with low self-esteem because you're focusing on what you do have rather than what you don't have, which is key.
The example you gave before about in a partnership, surrendering, even if you feel you are right, it seems like you still have to approach this carefully and not do the old, oh, you're right sort of routine and turn it into another fight.
No, it's not, oh, you're right, you know, which is, you know, filled with, you know, subliminal hostility. It's, you know something, you have a point. You know, you're really right. Thank you. You know, and just look at the person, and they're going to be shocked because you're not fighting with them if you usually fight with them. You know, and they're just, honey, I love you. You know, and just get into that instead of, well, you didn't this, and you didn't that, and you did that. You never blame. You know, surrender blame in any kind of communication with your spouse. It just will never work.
All right. Well, part
blaming,
two,
name calling, all of that. That's so retro. You don't ever want to do that. It doesn't work. So you've got to surrender that.
Retro. It's gone out of style to blame and name call.
It has. It's very 50s. They used to. My parents' generation used to blame, you know, blame and point fingers, and you know, it so doesn't work. And I hope everybody knows that you've got to surrender that. What does work is listening to your partner, is like feeling them with your heart, like not interrupting. And letting them know that you have faith in them, that they could handle things, you know, and that you respect them.
Much more to talk about with Dr. Judith Orloff. Her book is The Ecstasy of Surrender, 12 Surprising Ways Letting Go Can Empower Your Life. We'll come back and talk more with her and take your phone calls and emails, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782, our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Back with Judith and with you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today, Dr. Judith Orloff, psychiatrist and the author of The Ecstasy of Surrender, 12 Surprising Ways Letting Go Can Empower Your Life. Join us in this discussion about letting go to get what you want. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Tawasi in Glenwood, thanks for calling. Welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, I wanted to talk about how we have attachments, rather I'd like to hear you talk about how we have attachments to things that are unhealthy for us, like our mortgages or contracts for cars and phones, where we get underneath these obligations that are really don't serve us, you know, and how we just feel obligated, and then those obligations prevent us from those sorts of joys that we really should be out there seeing and feeling.
All right. Thanks for bringing that up. Thanks for that, Tawasi. And Judith, your response?
That's such a good point. We're in a consumer society, and so I'm up for reevaluating everything. But in terms of financial commitments that you have to pay off every month, you know, I really encourage the most minimal, you know, that you can live with, you know. So, you know, it's about tuning in and feeling what you can afford and not going beyond that and maybe sacrificing something. I don't know, take the bus or something. Don't have a car. I mean, I don't think having a car is all that important, you know, if you have public transportation. But to be able to minimize that, because I've seen so many people get attached, you know, to material things and then be a slave to them, paying off their mortgage, sending their children to private schools. You know, it's all okay, you know, if you can afford it easily, but what happens is people get caught in the trap of working all the time, you know, to pay all these things off, and then they're stressed out, and they don't get to live their lives. So it's about balance. It's not that any of these things are bad, the houses or the cars. It's just, you know, if they add to your sense of delight and wonder, you know, that's fine, but if they detract, you know, maybe you can scale down. I'm a big proponent of downsizing and simplicity, you know, and you know, not accumulating a lot of material things. I'm not interested in that myself. I don't think it's quite necessary to have that many things, you know. Develop more of an inner practice and connect to nature. It's just really a beautiful thing, and have minimal things. So I hope that addresses what you're bringing up.
Part two in the book is about reading people and communication. And Judith, if you're not terribly intuitive, is this something that it's going to take a fair amount of work to be able to read people better?
Not at all. But if you want to learn how to read people better, I can just give you some quick, you know, tips that are in the book. But I go through all kinds of ways, including reading body language. But the surrender, though, in this chapter is giving up the idea that you can't do it. You know, just in the way you phrase that sentence, you know, what if I'm not intuitive? I can't do it. Everybody can do it. I can't tell you, everybody that has read this chapter, or my patients who I've taught how to read people, everyone can do it. Like, for instance, if you're in a business meeting and you want to know how somebody is feeling about something, and let's say you're in a conference, just look under the table and see where their foot is pointed. That will show their allegiance, you know, and who they like. The feet, you know, if they're pointed towards a person, that's their allegiance. So
that's sort of the indicator species for the rest of the body, though, right? I mean, they're pointed at that person in general, right?
Only if they like them.
Huh. But, I mean, the feet are going to go with the rest of the body.
Not necessarily.
Really?
Your body, not necessarily. Your body can be pointing one way, but the feet, the toes are the indicators. So, you just take a peek under the table. I mean, just that one thing. Who can't do that? But that's been proven. Like, you know, I go through the techniques of the truth wizards, the people in the FBI who, you know, are expert interrogators. And so they've come up with all kinds of clues about how to tell lying, you know, how to, you know, get somebody to tell the truth, the approaches to take, and, you know, and just, you know, things like if a man touches a suprasternal notch, it might be a sign of lying, you know, or certain voice tones that I go through in the book. So, you know, there and certain, like, women who are tossing their hair, what that might mean, or you know, just stuff like that you can, you know, usually don't interpret, but that you could interpret, you know, or the certain words that people use. So, you know, I go through a whole, it's mainly a chapter full of lists, you know, in terms of what to look for. So it's not this deep, complicated technique. It's just look for these things, see if they help you in your communication, and you'll have all these secret weapons to read people.
But where it gets a little more complicated is when you advise people to sense emotional energy. And what's a good example there?
Well, what I'm suggesting is that people sense who drains your energy and who doesn't. I talk about people called energy vampires in the book, and these are people who suck your energy dry. So you can sense emotional energy by listening to your own body and seeing where you feel drained or tired or feel like taking a nap or suddenly you feel horrible or sick around somebody. That's you're sensing emotional energy as opposed to really positive people, and you sense, you know, your energy goes up, you feel lighter, you feel happier, you feel like hugging them, you know, whatever. It's a different response than the energy vampire response. And those are just two, you know, extreme examples. But you can sense if somebody's sad, you can sense if somebody's happy. You know, you can just get a sense of people. It's like animals, instinctual sensing of people around you. If you're really interested in them, you can, you know, use your intuition to sense where they're at. And sometimes people will put on a happy face, but yet, you know, they're really unhappy and miserable, so you might be able to feel that. And certainly as a psychiatrist, that gives me tremendous information about people, you know, in order, you know, to how to help them.
There's a big issue in here in this particular section of the book about reading people in communication, about how to communicate with difficult people. There are entire books on that, aren't there?
Oh, gosh, yes, as there should be. But that's one of the issues that I focus on in this book is, you know, how surrender can help you deal with difficult people, you know, and what you need to surrender. For instance, I talk about the anger addict, somebody who dumps toxic anger on you, or the narcissist, somebody who's just me, 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 and lacks any kind of empathy or heart and, you know, can really destroy a person's self-esteem. How do you deal with a spouse who's a narcissist or a boss that's a narcissist or the gossip? You know, how do you deal with a gossip? You know, somebody in the office is just talking about other people, you know, or how do you deal with the victim, someone who's always poor me and keeps you on the phone for 2 hours and you're exhausted after that? So, you know, number one, what you have to surrender is your reactivity. To stop reacting when your buttons get pushed. That's where people go wrong. Where an anger addict might push a button in you, so then you're off and yelling at them, and then you're into that dance, which is not good. All right, so with an anger addict, you know, you really need to set very clear limits and boundaries with them and not allow toxic anger around you. I mean, I take a very firm stance on this, that toxic anger is not allowed in relationships. It isn't, and one person should actually walk out if that's happening and not allow themselves to be subjected to that. It's very destructive. That in relationships, you have to learn to talk to one another, and if the only way somebody knows how to talk is to dump and yell and finger point and say horrible things they can't never take back, that's unacceptable. And so, you know, you need to walk out. I consider that abuse. personally. But, you know, it's natural to be angry. You made me mad, or I feel mad. You always phrase things in terms of I feel.
I language, not you language, right.
Yeah, I language, not you language, just as a relationship skill. You know, I feel this when we go through this, and this is a positive way to change it, offering solutions. You know, oftentimes it's good to ask your mate, you know, how do you want to be treated in this circumstance? You know, what can I say that will get through to you? And I did that with my partner about one thing he didn't like was, you know, if I offer suggestions or instruction when he's going through conflict, you know, how, you know, you want to fix it. You know, and he just told me to say, you know, just say, I know you can handle it. I have every faith that you can handle it, rather than offer instructions. And you see, and that's so useful to me, because now I won't offer instructions anymore. So, you know, it's good to find out what verbiage will work for your partner, you know, during different times. And then you just listen to it.
In a sense, that's kind of surrender too, though, because you're surrendering to the idea that you're always going to know what your partner needs, and you actually have to stop and ask.
Well, it's important to ask what your partner needs. It's very important to ask what they need. If you're not giving it to them, and you love them, you want to give them what they need, you know, really. And so sometimes you don't know. As to me, I tend to be a fixer, so I like to offer suggestions, and that's quite irritating to him. So it's good to know that. I don't need to offer suggestions. It's just my default. That's just I'm a fixer. I'm a solution person. But some men just like to hear, I know you can handle it. That's a supreme compliment.
We have an email here from Ray in Roseburg. He says, this is a wonderful topic. Isn't it sad that it takes so many of us so long to learn to surrender? To me, this has been the gospel of Jesus, but it has been a long struggle to just let go. Blessings to you. Keep up the great work.
Oh, thank you. Yes, it's, you know, human nature is very stubborn. And, you know, of course we want to control everything. That's human nature. But we just can't. And that's hard to accept. And I have tremendous compassion for that. I mean, I'd love to be able to control everything, I think. But I just can't. So I think once we accept that, and then in those areas where we can't exert control, to try other techniques, you know, that can help us. I'm not saying you can't exert control sometimes. You know, I think it's incredibly satisfying to exert control and have something happen. But it just doesn't work all the time.
In the section of the book on relationships, love, and sensuality, there's some obstacles you list here. What's a relationship empath?
Yes, a relationship empath is somebody who's an extremely sensitive person who can pick up energy and emotions and stress and symptoms from their partner. So instead of, and I'm one, so I have a particular interest in it. And so you pick up everything that your partner's feeling, and it can be very distressing because you don't want to do that. But because you're sensitive, and if you're making love with them especially, your energy fields are overlapping. And so you're picking up everything that they're feeling. And so you have to learn how not to do that, basically. It's one thing to have compassion, but it's another thing to just take on the stress of your partner. And, you know, there are ways of setting clear limits and boundaries, of protecting yourself, you know, through visualizations, of having conversations with the person. Like I had a patient whose husband was angry all the time, and she was a relationship empath. And she couldn't sleep with him because she kept picking up his anger, actually sleep at night. And he wouldn't deal with his anger, so she had to set a consequence that she's going to sleep in the other room until he's ready to deal with his anger. And he didn't like that, so that really motivated him, you know. So that was good. So now he was able to work through it with the therapist, and, you know, she doesn't pick it up anymore. But I just wanted to bring this up. It's very real. It happens if you're an empath, you're an emotional sponge, you pick up energy, you develop symptoms. Traditional medicine doesn't know about this. And they think it's either crazy or malingering, or, you know, you'll be sent to someone like me, a psychiatrist, to get an antidepressant. But that's not the treatment. You have to practice some of the boundary setting limits in the book, have a lot of alone time. And also it applies in illness if you're an empath. And there's a section I write in the book on empathic illnesses. And these are illnesses that you can literally pick up from other people. You can pick up their symptoms and even their diseases if you're extremely sensitive. You know, sometimes I've been around people with back pain, and suddenly I'm feeling back pain. So this is a very real phenomenon, but you have to learn to work with yourself to surrender that tendency to absorb and yet keep your sensitivity open. So this is a whole topic that fascinates me, but it means you have to let go of your tendency to absorb from other people at the same time staying open.
But it's, yeah, okay, so that is the point, to stay open. You're not reducing your sensitivity so much as just setting some boundaries.
Exactly, exactly. And people, many people are programmed that if they're compassionate people, then they'll take on the pain of others. That's just what their parents taught them or their spiritual practices taught them. And I really disagree with that. I think it's an old thought, and that you can be extremely compassionate without absorbing the stress or symptoms or pain of others. And certainly, if you want to be functional in the world, you can't absorb. You'll be a wreck. You know, there's so much suffering everywhere. If you're absorbing it, you know, I've seen people become recluses because they can't handle going out in the world. It's just too painful. And, you know, many people in 12-step programs are relationship empaths, and they're so sensitive that they drink and use to numb themselves. So, you know, or overeat, or sex addiction, you know, or, you know, food addiction. It's all in an attempt to numb yourself because you're too, quote, too sensitive. So, you know, in the book, I want to teach people how to surrender this old habit, let's put it, you know, as absorbing what's in other people so that you can maintain the integrity of your health and wellness and still be there for other people. You can be compassionate without taking on their stuff.
There's a whole lot of stuff in this book to consider, and I'm glad we've had the chance to spend some time together. The book is called The Ecstasy of Surrender, 12 Surprising Ways Letting Go Can Empower Your Life. Dr. Judith Orloff, thank you so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, you're welcome. And I just want to mention I'm going to be in Portland at Powell's on May 4th and at the Unity of Portland on May 5th. So people can come and hear me there.
Okay, Powell's and Unity Church in Portland, May 4th and 5th. Thank you so much again.
Thank you.
You bet. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about mosquito prevention as we get into the mosquito season. We'll talk about new funding for the Humboldt Bay Trail Project, long awaited. At 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the author of a book about higher education. The book is called Degrees of Inequality, about what's been happening to the higher education system in America. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duren, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange, here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great day.